Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Dana, we're seeing him coming from multiple directions here, to my left, which is just to the north, and to my right, to the south. They're over our head. I've counted at least half a dozen of this. Of them at this point. We're seeing them rising. I have yet to see them strike a target.
That was CNN's Jim Sciutto reporting from Tel Aviv Tuesday as Iran unleashed a barrage of ballistic missiles aimed at Israel. A dramatic escalation of hostilities that has the world on edge. The Iranian attack hit few of its targets and appears to have caused minimal casualties. The only reported death was of a Palestinian Arab in the West Bank. But the sheer scale of Iran's assault has prompted Israeli officials to warn that they too will respond. At a time and place of their own choosing, of course, even while the IDF continues with its own incursion into Lebanon to clear out fighters from a badly weakened Hezbollah, Iran's proxy army. Has Israel restored deterrence in the region by severely weakening Hezbollah and exposing Iran as a paper tiger? Or are we on the edge of a much wider, potentially catastrophic escalation? We'll talk to a leading expert on the Hezbollah-Iran nexus, Matthew Levitt, a former FBI and Treasury Department counterterrorism analyst, and now a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, on this episode of Spy Talk. Matt Levitt, welcome to Spy Talk. We were looking for somebody who could talk authoritatively on everything that's been going on in the battle between Israel, Hezbollah, and Iran. And I, of course, thought of you.
You looked for that guy, couldn't find him, and settled for me. I'm grateful.
And we got you. Help us to understand this Iranian missile attack on Israel. It's the second time Iran has conducted such a massive assault, and the second time it appears they've largely struck out. What did Iran fire at Israel? How did Israel, with the help of the United States and apparently others, strike them down? And how much comfort should the citizens of Israel take from this that they can now rest easy?
First of all, thank you for having me on the pod. It's great to be here. I think that back in April and now now today as well, people are going to downplay the attacks because there were so few casualties. That's a huge mistake. When you fire 180 ballistic missiles, you don't know that you are going to get off without killing a lot of people. This could have been very, very, very different. If it were not for the Israeli multi-tier air defense system, and let's be clear that the ballistic missiles rely almost exclusively on one of those tiers. Were it not for the U.S. And for some role played by Jordan and France and the U.K. and others, this would have been much, much worse. Iran clearly felt that it had to do something after a series of Israeli mind-boggling intelligence successes, from assassinating the head of Hamas in Tehran while he was there for the president's inauguration in an IRGC safe house, to the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, and effectively one of the key leaders of Iran's overall axis of resistance, its proxy network, to the almost dismantling of Hezbollah leadership, its fighting capacity. U.S. and Israeli officials are saying that the Israelis have taken out as much as 50% of Hezbollah's rockets already. This is mind-boggling. At the end of the day, though, Iran is in a pickle because Iran really has only one critical red line here. They're perfectly fine setting off fires throughout the region. And if there's a regional war that serves their purposes, that's fine with them, even if lots of people die. What they don't want, their one red line, is that violence bleeding back over the border into Iran. Because for Iran, that becomes a domestic issue. Iran is very concerned about looking weak to its domestic constituency that is not necessarily enamored by it. And so you have to anticipate that there's going to be an Israeli response. And where that goes from here, I'm too smart to try and tell you.
All right. Well, I want to unpack all of that, but just sort of starting out with the limited number of casualties, the only person apparently killed in this massive missile attack was a Palestinian Arab from Gaza who was in the West Bank. Israel is a small, densely populated country. It's hard to see how you can fire that many missiles and not end up hitting something. Now, there are some photos of debris. There was a school hit. But still, is it possible that Iran, fearing a wider war, is deliberately trying not to cause mass casualties in Israel? Or is it that they simply aren't capable of pulling something like this off?
This is absolutely not a situation where Iran is trying to restrain itself.
I mean, they've had two attacks, missile attacks on Israel, and they've barely caused any damage.
It's a commentary on their capabilities, which don't include at least so far, the use of precision-guided munitions that can be aimed at a specific building window. So they aimed a lot of things at Israeli headquarters. None of those hit. Some of them did, in fact, land, but nearby. And the fact is that the Israelis and Americans, with help from some others, including Arab states, knocked down a lot of these. You fire 180 ballistic missiles, you're trying to hit something.
Yeah, I mean, these were Fatah 2 missiles, hypersonic, with a speed of up to 10,000 miles per hour. I mean, granted, Israel's Iron Dome and its missile defense is pretty sophisticated and obviously very good. But still, I mean, those seem like pretty powerful, fast-moving missiles that one would expect would hit some of its targets.
Fast-moving ballistic missiles just means it gets to what it's going to hit quickly. It doesn't comment on what it's going to hit or whether it will be knocked out of the sky. It does mean you have a lot less time to be able to identify them and knock them down. And it does mean that basically only one of the four tiers of Israel's air defense system will be relevant for these types of systems. So this is a really stark difference from what happened in April, where the Iranians really kind of projected, made it clear that stuff was coming. Then they sent things in three waves. They sent drones that basically go the speed of a car. They sent low altitude cruise missiles that basically go the speed of a commercial airliner. And then they fired a small number of ballistic missiles, which is all they fired this time, which go in, the distance in about 12 minutes. And so this time there was no forward warning. There was none of the slow stuff. This was a significant ratcheting up of their efforts. And there is no question in my mind, but that there will be a response. I hope it is not targeting the oil industry, because that would affect the price of oil around the world. And it would also probably lead Iran to target oil installations in Gulf states, which they've threatened already they would do. I think that the Israelis will be considering hitting something related to the nuclear program. And there certainly is public talk about that.
On that point, Matt, I want to read you from some of what Naftali Bennett
posted on X in the aftermath of the attack. Bennett, of course, is the former prime minister of Israel. And he wrote, "We must act now to destroy Iran's nuclear program, its central energy facilities, and to fatally cripple this terrorist regime. We must remove this terrible threat to our children's future. Now is the moment. This opportunity must not be missed." That sounds like a full-scale call for regime change, to destroy the Iranian regime.
There are definitely people in Israel who have felt enough is enough, and it's time to deal with the strategic threat posed by Iran and its nuclear program. And the nature of this regime, they believe, is what is behind not only the nuclear threat, but the sponsorship of proxies that has led to October 7th and the year of fighting they've seen since. There is across the Israeli political spectrum general agreement that they no longer want to live with a gun to their head, not from Hamas in the south, not from Hezbollah in the north. And the question is, does that translate into a bigger type of response against Iran for the ballistic missile attack, or is the Israeli response more restrained? I honestly can't tell you what they will decide. I don't think they've decided.
But look, you're talking about a bigger response. And I should point out, by the way, that Jake Sullivan, the White House National Security Advisor, did make reference to that there will be severe consequences to what Iran did from this. So that was pretty striking language from the United States. But Bennett is going beyond that. He's talking about destroying the government of Iran, regime change. And if that is where the thinking in Israel is, does that make sense to you? Or should the United States be doing everything it can to restrain Israel from doing what Bennett is talking about there?
Look, I would make a distinction between what the politicians, especially politicians who are out of government, maybe want to get back in, are saying, and what the actual Israeli kind of military folks are pointing to. I think that there's going to be concern here in the United States if the sense is that Israel wants to do something really huge to the extent of regime change in Iran. Short of that, both National Security Advisor Sullivan and Secretary of Defense Austin, speaking the day before the ballistic missile strike, said there would be severe consequences, Austin, if there were an attack, and Sullivan after the fact. What remains to be seen is what that looks like. What is the U.S. role going to be in those severe consequences? If the U.S. severe consequences are another round of sanctions, look, I'm a former senior Treasury official. Sanctions have an important place in this, but that would be meaningless, and I think would be undermining our word and deterrence. What the U.S. does next on its own or with Israel will be important for our standing vis-a-vis the Iranians moving forward.
So wait, if sanctions are meaningless, and you think that what Bennett is talking about, it goes too far, if I heard you correctly, so what is a appropriate military response to this?
I'm not a military planner, but it seems to me there is going to be a military response. What you want to see is one that is something more than demonstrative, something that will take out a capability, much like the Israelis have done to Hezbollah in Lebanon. They've not just been targeting low-hanging fruit. They have been carrying out strikes that actually make it more difficult for Hezbollah to present threats to Israel, do that in such a way, perhaps, that makes it more difficult for your adversary to then respond in kind. The Israelis have never asked America to fight their fights. I don't see them starting now. They have articulated their position that they think that Iran presents threats not just to them. I think they're right in that. And so there's multiple ways the U.S. can play an assisting role, and we'll leave it to the military folks to figure that out. I think without question, Iran and its adversaries have to be convinced that from here on out, there will be actual costs And the reason they keep doing the things they've been doing over decades is because there have not been tangible costs.
Iran has a new president, Masoud Pezeshkian. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And in the Iranian political context, he's viewed as a moderate. He has made numerous statements, given numerous press interviews, in which he's made clear Iran does not want a wider war or a direct conflict with Israel. Should we take him at his word?
Michael, there's a very big difference between a moderate and a reformist. He's a reformist. He's part of the system, which makes him not terribly moderate. So he's the face that's going to go forward and say, well, we want stability, even as his government is doing all kinds of very aggressive military things. We want an end to sanctions, even as they're not willing to do the things that are required of them on the nuclear file. It's going to have to take something more than talk by someone who's a reformist primarily on domestic issues and has articulated a very strong support stance for the nuclear program and for support for proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas. So to my mind, there's nothing terribly moderate about that.
We'll now take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back with Matt Levitt. While fending off these missile attacks, the IDF has made what it described as a limited incursion into Lebanon. We're already this morning, Wednesday morning, as we're speaking, getting reports of casualties. As many as 7 Israelis have been killed in clashes with Hezbollah in the last 24 hours or so. Look, Israel has invaded Lebanon before 3 times over the years, and things have not gone well in those prior incursions. Is there a risk here for Israel in going into southern Lebanon? And, you know, especially with these initial reports of casualties, are we looking at a situation where this is going to get a lot bloodier and messier than people in Israel might have anticipated?
There's always the chance that things take a turn for the worse. I would suggest that the Israelis would tell you that the risk of not doing this is greater than the risk that it goes south. And it seems to me they've earned a little bit of respect over the past couple of weeks in terms of the series of astonishing intelligence and military successes they've had. The Israelis have said for years that since their poor performance, as they describe it, they were very self-critical about their performance in the last war with Hezbollah in 2006. They've been very clear that since then they have completely rejiggered their entire approach to what, in their terminology, a third Lebanon war would look like. And it's clear that their new effort at intelligence collection and actionable intelligence has been very, very successful. Now, anybody who thought that there weren't going to be casualties if the Israeli forces went into Lebanon just watches too many movies. And I think it's perhaps because if you look at the war in Gaza, it's also astounding how few casualties the Israelis have suffered. Here, what the Israelis have found already, I think, underscores the importance of what they're doing. After the 2006 war, UN Security Council Resolution 1701 was very clear. Hezbollah was not supposed to deploy at all south of the Litani River. They were not supposed to be rearmed. Both of those things happened anyway. Hezbollah rearmed many, many times over. They sent huge numbers of people to the south, and they built massive military infrastructure that the Israelis have already been documenting and making public. My hope is that the Israelis achieve their mission in the south, remove the Hezbollah infrastructure for the towns and villages within a few kilometers of the border, and go back home. Will that happen?
How long?
We're talking weeks, but again, I can't tell you that things don't go south because it's war.
I gotta say, weeks can lead to mission creep. If you're there for weeks,
Michael, any military action can lead to mission creep. You and I are sitting here in the United States. If you're sitting in Israel, you don't have a choice. 11 and a half months of almost daily rocket fire from Hezbollah, it's enough. I get it.
Was Hezbollah planning for a October 7th-like attack on northern Israel? We've seen reports about tunnels and other military infrastructure that have suggested to some that that's what they had in mind.
There is no question, zero question, that Hezbollah developed a plan to do just that. In fact,
why didn't they do it then? Why didn't they do it right after October 7th?
Well, back up a second. Get before October 7th, because one of the surprises was that Hamas did this from Gaza on October 7th, as opposed to Hamas from Lebanon. I've been going to Israel's northern border for many years, and almost every year the Israeli military briefs me on the new stuff they found out about this plot and what they have done to counter it. You'll recall they found tunnels dug under the border several years. I've been in one of those tunnels. This is a lot of time and effort and money. The Israelis don't know why Hezbollah didn't do this on October 8th, and had Hezbollah done it, they would have penetrated far into Israel. There were a total of about 650 Israeli soldiers along the entire northern border that day. Not all of them were combat. They immediately ferried people up to the north in helicopters and feel very lucky that Hezbollah didn't do what it wanted to do. But now they've already in the past 24 hours made public detailed maps that they've found in Hezbollah bunkers and villages on the Lebanese side of the border, documenting where the villages are, where the military is. It's the exact parallel to the type of material found on Hamas attackers in the days after October 7th. And the Israelis say that when they killed Ibrahim Akil several days ago, about a week ago, right after the pagers and walkie-talkies exploded, that he and a group of some 15 to 20 Radwan Hezbollah special forces commanders were meeting in person to plan just that type of attack, to put it in motion. And they were killed during that meeting, according to the Israelis.
So they were planning that for when? Because the timing still seems a bit of a mystery here. They obviously had a opportunity to attack in the aftermath of October 7th.
Well, they had many, many opportunities. Clearly, right. This was a capability they wanted to hold on to. If you look at the videos the Israelis have released from what they found in these bunkers just in the past 48 hours, forward positions, weapons, and all kinds of stuff ready to go. I think they felt that they were pushed to the point of wanting to do it after the pager and walkie-talkie attack, mm-hmm. Which was not only something that took out their wartime communication system, but put out of commission some 2,000 to 3,000 injured operatives. These were not pagers, by the way, that your Hezbollah employee at a hospital or a clinic would wear. These were for wartime, and they wanted to do something big back and were thwarted.
So when I was covering terrorism in the aftermath of 9/11, I remember going to multiple briefings in which counterterrorism experts would talk about how, as menacing as Al-Qaeda was, Hezbollah was the A-team when it came to international terrorism organizations. And you wrote a book a few years ago, Hezbollah, the Global Footprint of Lebanon's Party of God, in which you talked about how Hezbollah was the sort of primary and most lethal terrorist organization in the world. And yet, in just the last few weeks, it looks like they have been seriously damaged, if not dismantled. Was Hezbollah a paper tiger? Did we overestimate its strength and capabilities?
No, I don't think we did. What we underestimated was the Israeli conviction to fix the mistakes from 2006 and be prepared to really take the fight to Hezbollah. And they put so much time and resources and effort into this because the threat was so real. Mind you, they still pose a very significant threat. U.S. and Israeli authorities are quoted in the New York Times today as saying that they believe that Israel has knocked out as much as 50% of Hezbollah's rockets. Let's even say that's true, which would be mind-blowing. That still leaves them 75,000 to 100,000 rockets. As you look at Hezbollah's capabilities in the recent years, it's really focused on its military militia activities in Syria and elsewhere. But it also has an international terrorist capacity, the Unit 910 or Islamic Jihad organization. And as I look at the various components of Hezbollah, most of which have had leadership killed over the past few years, the Islamic Jihad organization, the terrorist wing, has not. Talal Hamia, its leader, is still out there. And if I were Hezbollah looking to be able to do something against Israel at a time when I'm less capable of doing that with rockets, I'm less capable of doing a cross-border raid, that's what I would be looking to do, to carry out an attack abroad. And even just this week, there were Hezbollah operatives arrested in Argentina on an illicit finance plot, they say. But when they raided their apartment, they found weapons.
Did Hezbollah, were they involved in the bombing of the Jewish center in Argentina back in the 1990s?
Yes.
That was a Hezbollah operation?
The 1994 bombing of the Amia Jewish Community Center was carried out by Hezbollah, a Hezbollah suicide bomber named Ibrahim Bero. Iran played a role in supporting that. About a year and a half earlier, they blew up the Israeli embassy, also in Buenos Aires, in 1992. In between, they tried to blow up the Israeli embassy in Thailand and nearly succeeded, except that the suicide bomber got into a fender bender on his way to the target and fled the scene and left his car bomb for police to find. And there have been many other plots around the world.
Were all these plots and attacks approved or directed by Nasrallah?
It's really difficult to say what the chain of command is for approving these things. I think it's safe to say that the really big international plots, there's no way that he would not know about. He sat at the top of the Jihad Council, not only as the Secretary General of Hezbollah, but I think there's really not unclassified material pointing to a phone call or a letter where he says, yes, go right. Do it. It's more of an assumption.
But how weakened is Hezbollah by the mere fact of his assassination by Israel last week?
The first thing to point out is that we're not talking about just a decapitation. This is more like open heart surgery, because it's not just the removal of Nasrallah. It's the removal of dozens of people below him and all kinds of capabilities. But Nasrallah was truly unique. Most people have focused on his skills as a speaker, as an orator, and that was definitely true. He grew up as a gunman. He had extremely close relations with Iranian leaders and the Quds Force. He was a unique leader, and everyone assumes, myself included, that he'll be succeeded by Hashim Safieddine, the head of Hezbollah's executive council, a relative of Nasrallah, a relative by marriage into the Qasem Soleimani family. Safieddin is a dangerous guy. He's nowhere near as capable as Nasrallah was.
In your book, you start out the book with an account of plots for spectacular terror attacks in Baku in Azerbaijan, car bombings, the kidnapping of an Israeli ambassador, the blowing up of a radar station. And the guy who was arrested for that, one of two, was a Hezbollah leader named Ali Karaki. And you identify him in the start of the book, this chilling account of plans for massive terrorist attacks. Ali Karaki later got released and was at that meeting with Nasrallah that was bombed by the Israelis, and he too was killed in that strike. So that was a pretty effective counter-terror strike for the Israelis that went beyond just getting rid of Nasrallah.
And again, it's not just Nasrallah, it's not just Ali Karaki. It's Fuad Shukr, it's Ibrahim Akil. The three of them, Fuad Shukr, Ibrahim Akil, and Ali Karaki, were the triumvirate that kind of succeeded the last Hezbollah military commander, Mustafa Badruddin, who was killed reportedly by the Iranians in Syria. He succeeded his brother-in-law, Imad Mughniyeh, who was killed in a joint U.S.-Israeli operation in Syria in 2008. And it's a bunch of people for each of the regional military commands below them. Like I said, this is not a decapitation. It's not even a series of decapitations. This is open heart surgery.
Now, one thing that leapt out at me in reading that passage in your book is you talked about how Karaki, in plotting those terrorist attacks, was working closely with Iranian intelligence agents. Now, we all know about the interrelationship between Iran and Hezbollah. Iran funds Hezbollah. It arms Hezbollah. But working closely with Iranian intelligence agents, U.S. intelligence officials have said they have information, intelligence about Iranian plots to kill U.S. officials, assassinate U.S. officials, including, of course, former President Trump for his directing the attack that killed Soleimani, the IRGC leader. But Hezbollah, as far as I know, they've always had a coterie of supporters and agents in the United States. Is there reason to think that Hezbollah operatives in the United States are working with Iranian intelligence agents to plot assassination attacks on U.S. officials?
Look, two parallel projects I run at the Washington Institute are mapping projects where we map out Hezbollah's international plots, and a more recent one where we're mapping out Iranian external operations. And one of the things we have to do is there's some overlap between those, because there are cases where Hezbollah guys will participate in an Iranian plot and vice versa. In the United States, we've not seen that, probably because it's a place where we pay much more attention to Iranian leadership that typically is only allowed to be in a certain radius of the UN facility in New York. But we have seen Hezbollah carry out surveillance here in the United States. And one of the reasons that law enforcement is really at peak concern right now is because one of the cases we had in the past few years involved a guy named Ali Karani. Cards on the table. I was the government's expert witness in that case. He was convicted on all counts. He was doing surveillance throughout the New York area. He described himself as a sleeper cell. I don't like to use the term. It sounds too Hollywood, but he used it about himself. And when asked by the FBI, under what circumstances do you think you might be called upon by your Hezbollah superiors to actually carry out, to act on the pre-operational surveillance of targets you've already done, he said, well, I don't know, but maybe some type of war with Iran. Certainly if there was someone killed Hassan Nasrallah. So here we are on the verge of some type of war with Iran. Certainly Israel and the Iranians, you know, shooting rockets at each other, and Hassan Nasrallah assassinated. And so there's really a lot of concern, and frankly, even more so because this is coinciding with the Jewish high holiday season, which presents additional targets. Neither Iran nor Hezbollah have traditionally made a distinction between Israelis and Jews. And he pointed to the Amia Jewish Community Center bombing in 94. That was not an Israeli target. Those were just Argentinian Jews. And we've had situations both by Hezbollah and even by Iran in this country. At one point, Iranian agents primarily here to do surveillance of the Mujahideen-e Khalq rallies around the country did surveillance of a synagogue for students at a university in the Midwest.
That's fascinating. The guy, the Hezbollah agent you were referring to who was prosecuted, what was his name again?
Ali Karani, K-O-U-R-A-N-I.
Okay, last question for you. We saw each other at this counterterrorism conference in New York a few weeks ago for the anniversary of 9/11, and you gave a talk there about all the steps U.S. and Western officials could take to further weaken the Iranian regime and its support of counterterrorism. You weren't talking, as I recall it, about massive bombings or military strikes on nuclear facilities. You had a sort of different set of options that you thought should be pursued. Why don't you tell us about some of those and what you think is most realistic right now?
Look, from my experience as a government official, it's all about the toolkit. It's not about any one tool. And I'm a former senior Treasury official. I think sanctions have a very important place in this. But we've gotten to a point where for many people, every problem is a nail and every solution is a hammer. Every problem has a sanctions solution. And that's not the case. So look, I think the number one thing, the most single most important thing we need to do is to lead an international effort to prevent Iran from being able to provide funding and weapons to its proxies. Without Iranian money and, more importantly, weaponry, Hezbollah is nowhere near the threat it is now. The Houthis are a small thorn in the Saudi backside and not a threat to international shipping. For years, I mean, decades, we have tolerated this activity. We refused to take action to thwart it. There may be a military kinetic component to that. If we issue warnings and they don't stop, maybe you got to blow up a boat at some point or detain a boat. But we need to prevent Iran from being able to help either Hamas or Hezbollah become again what they once were. There are other things I think we need to be doing as well. I think that it blows the mind that so the children of so many really, really, really bad Iranian regime actors are able to send their children to university in the West, including here in the United States, that so many of their wives go on regular shopping trips to Paris and New York. The State Department has visa sanctions authorities that can prevent people from coming into this country. Even things like that, I think, will start the very beginning of having costs. There are no costs on Iran. And at the end of the day, Iran really does hate being portrayed as an international pariah. And I think we need to think very carefully about the level of diplomatic engagement. Europeans in particular are very wary of having their embassy shut down. I think the Iranians need that diplomatic engagement as much as the Europeans want it. And it's okay if you're represented by a deputy chief of mission as opposed to an ambassador. The Iranians have to get a message that there will be a cost to carrying out operations in foreign countries, to supporting groups that are carrying out acts of murder, et cetera. And we just haven't done that. And there's a lot more that we need to be done. And the last thing I would say is, you know, my book on Hezbollah, we just re-released a new version with a new chapter that's focused in part on Hezbollah's role in the lead up to October 7th, but also Hezbollah's role regionally across the Middle East, well beyond Lebanon, in helping to play a kind of a quarterback role for Iran, helping the rest of Iran's proxy network. And I think that's something that can be disrupted as well.
Okay, well, it does strike me that you're probably going to have to do yet another update for your Hezbollah book after the events of the last several weeks. Matt Levitt, I want to thank you for joining us on Spy Talk, and hope we can do it again.
I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.com news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops, original analysis on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, High Up MAGA Guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jolie Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar, available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.